to accept the thing, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. On Zoom, you can raise your hand and somebody will chat with you. All veterans here? Really? Wow. All right. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple actions. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the normal format of this meeting is an open big book step study where we have a panel of speakers. And then once we go through all the 12 steps, we have an amazing, awesome event like this. And we have somebody come in and tell their story. And tonight, I'm very excited to hear Brian made his way all the way from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So I'm not going to take up any of his time. Come on up.
Thank you very much. You.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brian. And it's good to be here sober tonight. My sobriety date is June 27th of 1984. I am a member of the There's More to Life group, which is located in scenic Lemoyne, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Harrisburg. And if that means nothing, somewhere between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh is sort of where we are. I have a sponsor. I sponsor a bunch of people and have, you know, pretty continuously since 1985. And many of them sponsor people who sponsor people, you know, down the line. I've had that transformative experience that Alcoholics Anonymous offers to alcoholics through the practice of the 12 steps, what in a shorthand we refer to as a spiritual awakening. And so what I'll try to do tonight is think about what the literature describes when we talk about what we were like, what happened, what we are like now, and how we developed a relationship with a power greater than ourselves sufficient to relieve us of our alcoholism. I always say that because that's the standard. Now, you can judge how wildly short of that standard I fall, but at least we know what we're going for. And I want to thank Dave, of course, very much for asking me and for all the people who put this on. When I first came to AA, and you know, there'd be coffee and all that stuff, in my head, it was basically like there were AA fairies who just sort of popped in, did all this stuff and left. I really didn't put it together for a while that the reason there was a solution for me when I walked in the door was because people I didn't know had taken the time to carry the message to other people I didn't know, who carried it on until finally when I walked in the door, I walked through a door into a room with people who had recovered from alcoholism, understood the illness, and were able to share with me how to do that and what their experience had been like and how they had done it. We'll start there. Now, I tend to start all over the place. And so I know some people are sort of very linear. Think non-linear algebra. That's me. This, for whatever reason, came back tonight. I was thinking about it. I was in college at the time. Actually, I went to the same college as Dr. Bob. So we had a long-standing tradition of alcoholic drinking. I had a date. This was it. Like, I know somebody else was it last week, but like this, she was it. Lynn was her name, and it still is. But and we were going to go out to this place that she really liked for dinner. And I, you know, Lynn was smart and beautiful and really engaging, untreated adult child of an alcoholic. She was sort of hitting on every one of my criteria, even though I didn't understand that that's what some of them were. We were And I think, and I'm thinking like, this is the beginning, right? And then it is the rest of my life will be perfect. So we're going to meet at 6 and I'm thinking we'll do this. And classes finish about 12:30. It's this beautiful October day in New Hampshire. And I'm walking back and I have the plan. I have a bunch of homework I'm going to knock out. I have a couple other things to clean up, shower, get changed, dressed, ready to go. Between the place I left and the place I lived was a place I drank. And as I'm walking by, this thought hit. I wonder if anybody's in there. You know, that's it. Just like idle curiosity. For those of us sort of like intellectually curious about all possibilities, that's one. And how would I answer that? Well, I'd have to go inside and then I'd know. But I'm just going to go in, say hi, maybe have a few, and then I'm going home because I have all this stuff to do and I am in love. So I go inside and sure enough, big surprise, the guys I drank with were in there on a Friday afternoon. And so I start. And two things were happening at that time that I did not understand. The first was that something was happening in my head that no matter what I had wanted to do, it inevitably led me back to a drink. That every path in my head led back to a drink. And the second thing that was happening was once I started drinking, the switch was on. And I didn't know that until I got sober, when people talked about the phenomenon of craving, that allergy to alcohol, not meaning that it makes me sick, but meaning that I have an abnormal reaction to it. Whereas something inside of my non-alcoholic wife says enough, I don't have that. I basically, the only way I could drink more is if I had a second throat, because pour it down. It's just how there's nothing social about it. So we start drinking and then it gets fuzzy. And then I look up and it's 10 to 6 and I am hammered. But you know, I'm a man who keeps his commitments. So I used to say I ran, but actually it's better. I staggered with purpose back to where I live. I no shower, none of that's happening now because we don't have a window. And I rip off and then I try to get dressed and I stagger back to where she is. Come around the corner and she's standing out there and she looks so beautiful and everything dropped. And I put that smile, that unsmile, that took that smile from the face of everybody who loved me. And it was the last thing I meant to do. But I was, as the result of alcoholism, I didn't even know I was drinking without my own permission. I didn't understand that's what was happening to me. And I come from by the way, Lynn is happily married to someone else. And my name is actually, my wife's name is Linda, not Lynn. It's not her. That's what my drinking always looked like. One of the things that became clear to me in Alcoholics Anonymous was that one of those behavioral differences between alcoholics and non-alcoholics, that while non-alcoholics tend to change their behavior to meet their goals, alcoholics change their goals to meet their behavior. And so if I wanted something and I couldn't have it in drink, I would take less. And then I would say, oh, this is okay. And then I would take less. And if it doesn't get worse than this, it's fine. Okay. Weirdly enough, I can actually go down another rung and I'm okay. And the thing about that I actually also came to understand over time is that's a symptom of alcoholism, not a symptom of drinking. And if I do not treat the spiritual illness, I will live that same life dry, except instead of being drinking, it will generally be managing self-centered fear, and which I will manage by not doing things and telling myself, oh, I don't need to do that. I don't need to do that. Or reaching back to on the waterfront and say, I could have been a contender, but for you. I had the wrong fill in the blank, parents, coach, teacher, siblings, whatever it was. So the alcoholic self-pity masks and tries to justify the fear-driven alcoholic life, all at the same time with writhing self-loathing underneath it, knowing none of it's true. And eventually, if we live that way long enough, the thought of staying sober becomes, in my experience, most people who are sober and drink again don't drink because they want to drink. They drink because they can't stand being sober anymore. And if we don't really treat the illness, that's what will happen to us. And so back to the story. I was drinking. I'm in college drinking, drank in the same places as Dr. Bob. Similar results, although I had a faster progression than he did, I think. Or they had a better safety net. I'm not sure. But everything is falling apart, and people are, you know, trying to help me. And the problem is they're offering me help that I'm not interested in, because all of the help they're offering me is premised on the fact that I have to change. I'm not interested in that. I want the help that says I don't have to do anything and the consequences will change. Consequences anonymous. That's what I was looking for. I didn't know it existed. It actually does not. Other than in the alcoholic brain. And so at one point I got, there was this dean who was in charge of disciplinary issues. And so he knew me well. And he calls me into his office. And the reason he called me, I'm in there and a friend of mine is in there. And he says, why you're here is your friend has reached out to me because she's afraid you're going to drink yourself to death. I was 19. And he said, basically, blah, 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 you'll do this. And then he said, you don't have to do this. He said, I've scheduled an appointment for you this afternoon with a drug and alcohol counselor. So if you want to go do that, you can do it. Now that's what he said. And he's trying to offer me help. What I heard was, Brian, could you do a favor for me? Could you please go see a drug and alcohol counselor and I'll owe you one? And I'm thinking, like, this is not a bad guy to owe because he's always on me. So so I go to see the drug and alcohol counselor, and I do what active alcoholics do with counseling. I show up when I can, unless I can't. I show up under the influence, and I lie. And then I get sober, and I say, these therapists couldn't help me at all. No wonder they can't. And there's that line in the Big Book that talks about how many physicians have such a low opinion of us. No wonder. You're trying to help people on the basic premise that they'll tell you what's wrong with them. And people like us are running it through every filter except what is true. The filter I'm running it through is, what effect do I think this is going to have on what you think about me? And what do I think I can say that will cause you to do what I want you to do? So we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. But that's where I came from. So that didn't help. I continued to get worse. I got in more trouble, and I had a moment of grace, which is for the first time, I could see that the trouble I was in was in some way related to my drinking. And I mean, looking at me and people saying, I'm afraid you're going to drink yourself to death, you would have thought that detail would have been a little clearer earlier, but it was not. I had that, the alcoholic problem that sort of like, once we admit we're alcoholic, all that really happens is it becomes unanimous because everybody else already knew it. That's how I was. And so I initiated a meeting with my friendly disciplinary dean and said, there's something wrong. I think I have a problem. And he said, basically, I will violate all of the disciplinary rules and get you out of the trouble you're in if you will agree to go to rehab. Now, I did not know what rehab was. I mean, I really didn't know anything about this. But I finally understood the whole thing is that I have alcoholism. And if you say to me, I will get you out of the trouble you are in today if you commit to doing something in the future, the answer is always yes, and we'll let the future take care of itself. I might not even be here when it comes. So, I'm not going to worry about that. So I said yes, but I was thinking I'll go. And that was on, I'll never forget, it was on a Friday. And Saturday, I'm going. And Sunday, it's getting fuzzier. And Monday, I'm thinking, I think people do this because they're in trouble. I'm not in trouble. So why would I go? So I lied my way out of it and didn't. It's embarrassing to look back on. But I didn't go. Two weeks later, I was living in a second story of a building in a corner room, and there were two windows. My corner, there were two windows. One window led out to a sun deck, and we used to crawl headfirst through that and drink on the sun deck. And one window did not. And in a blackout, I crawled through the wrong window. So I fell two stories into a concrete window well. I fractured my skull. I all kinds of other damage. And I was not expected to survive because I had lost so much blood. And when I got stabilized, I was not expected to be able to recover meaningfully because I had such significant head injuries. And I mean, basically I skated from that. Honestly, I have minor things. I get double vision every day. I have parts of my face I can't feel still. I mean, things like that, but I have back issues, but nothing. But I mean, compared to what it looked like, nothing happened to me. The thing about that that became clear to me after some time sober was that I got the gift of opportunity. And I've been on borrowed time for a long time. And the thing about all those is, what do I do with it? Am I making it matter? Or is it just a waste? You know, should it have been given to someone else? So I'm hospitalized, I'm unconscious for a week, and I get flown home, and there's my family is unhappy, as you might imagine. But they took me in, which they didn't have to do, which I couldn't see that for a while. All I could see was how bitter and angry they were. So unjustified. I was then told, now the dean was not suggesting anything anymore. And he said, if you ever want to come back here, you'll do a bunch of things. But one of them was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that became clear to me again that I learned over time is that idea of what a bottom looks like. See, I thought the bottom was when I fell out of the window. That wasn't really the bottom. Those are external events. A bottom is internal. If the bottom was external, we would just manufacture it. If it's get people arrested for DUI, we'd get them drunk with the police waiting, give them the car keys, the police would be there, boom, now you're sober. If it's their spouse leaving them, we'd go say, I know this sounds crazy, you've got to leave. And they'll say, it doesn't sound crazy at all. They'll say, but you got to come back also. But that's, it's not that. It's internal. And at least one of the ways I understand it is that moment where that something we just lost, or the next thing we're about to lose, and we can see it, somehow matters more than drinking. It matters enough that we're willing to do something different. And that's different for everybody. And far too many of us die before we get there. For me, for whatever reason, it was school. And that was, I'd always loved school since I was a kid. It was the kind of where I was coming from, neighborhood and family wise. It was the way out. So I went to AA solely for that. Now, I walked into my first AA meeting. I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous at all. I had never heard the phrase 12-step program. I knew there were meetings, the end. And you weren't supposed to tell people who was there. I understood what the word anonymity meant also. But that was it. And so I'm in this church and I go into this room and I sit down and this woman's talking. And then I realize she's talking about God. And I thought, like, I'm in the revival room, you know, I've got to get out of here and figure out where the alcoholics, because they're, you know, because everybody looks like you. They don't look like alcoholics. They don't, you know, there's nobody with the beard, the long coat, like the 1930s hobo film or something like that. They don't look like that. And so I'm ready to leave as soon as she finishes, because if I have mastered anything, it is the quick escape. And so she finishes and I'm about to go. And then the next woman says, my name's Helen and I'm an alcoholic. I thought, be my grandmother. She was probably my age now, but you know, she seemed eight. When you're 19, everybody seems ancient. But, and then she said, my sobriety date is November, I think it was November 3rd of 1964. Seems like an odd thing to remember. But the reason I remember it is because I was born in September of 1964. And I had never heard the phrase sobriety date before. You know, the guys I drank with, we didn't use the phrase sobriety date. What's your sobriety date? Tomorrow. But I knew when she said that she meant she had not had a drink almost my entire life, which seemed not only not possible, but not even desirable, really. But then it's going around the room and all these people are talking. And what they were starting to talk about was they were talking about things like what in our literature we describe the four horsemen: terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. And I knew that, but they were talking about being on the other side of it, and I did not know that was possible, because I viewed the world as a you know, everybody gets dealt a hand. Some people get rich, healthy, athletic. Some people get terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. All four suits, totally unmatched, unused, unplayable hand. And that's the one I'm going to get. And people welcomed me in AA. And I was very, very fortunate. I mean, I believe this, that I was welcomed by people who understood their problem and understood the solution and were willing to share it with me. They were kind and direct and gave me suggestions, but I had this problem, among many others. I had the classic alcoholic problem, which is I come into a room like this, I scan the room, I listen to try to figure out what is the absolute minimum I need to know to get through these conversations and to do, to position myself so I can do what I want to do. And then I try to figure out how I can do just slightly less than that and still make it and go. And because despite what people were telling me, I did not understand what alcoholism was. People talked about it as an illness, as a disease. And there were a couple of people, I think, who had diabetes in the group. So they kept comparing it to diabetes and you know, you had to treat it certain ways and it would come back if you didn't, blah, blah, all that sort of stuff. And but what I'm thinking is this is excellent for you. Going to meetings every day, like if I didn't have this very active social life of sitting alone in my room resenting people, I could go to a meeting every day as well. But I don't really have that. I'm kind of already committed tomorrow night to this, so I'm not doing that. And I, you know, a sponsor, excellent if you need someone to tell you what to do. But see, I am uniquely gifted in that, like every other alcoholic, I am slightly smarter than every other alcoholic in the room. That's AA is comprised of everybody who is slightly smarter than everybody else in the room. And the problem is there were things about that that are so central to my belief system because I didn't understand the illness. I would see things like, why am I so insightful? Because it is really obvious to me what everybody else should do. And if they just did it, we'd all be happy. That's not insight, that's illness. That is what being trapped in the bondage of self looks like. That is what radical self-centeredness looks like. It's obvious to me how everybody should behave because I think if they'll behave that way, I'll feel okay. And if they behave that way and it turns out I was wrong, I'll be irritated at them for their failure to improve and move it along. You know, but I might give them some grace in case I misled them at first. But that's you know, selfishness and self-centeredness, the root of our problems, that's how I'm hitting the world. And besides, I don't need STEP. I mean, STEP's excellent if you guys need directions. I'm not a directions guy. I'm like, you know, go to the end and then throw away the extras. And if it doesn't work, say, oh, poorly manufactured. But I also know what I need. I need money. I used to say a job, but really source of money. Low effort, high reward. I need a relationship. Low effort, high reward. And if I have those two things, I'll be fine. And once I get those and I get my life all lined up, then yeah, like this other stuff, maybe I'll be, you know, really interested in higher power, which I'm, you know, oh, I'm totally convinced that's not God. Yeah, you guys have me fooled. So there I am. And people suggested, so I didn't take the suggestions. And what happened to me is what happens to alcoholics who manage to put down the drink, but otherwise don't treat their alcoholism, which is I don't get better. I get worse. There's this sentence on page, I'm not very good with pages, but I think it's 51 of the big book. And I'm not a good quoter either, but the concept is it says something like, when we tell our stories, we talk about leaving aside the drink problem. We talk about why we made such a heavy going of life, or words to that effect. Leaving aside the drink problem, my untreated alcoholism started to twist. And I'm, you know, paralyzing depression, murderous rage, sometime in the space of the same thing, for like minutes. And I'm sitting in meetings, and the problem with being self-centered is that everything comes at you. So when I'm sitting in a meeting and someone says, I just got the best new job, I'm so grateful to be sober, I don't hear Sally just got a great new job. To me, my experience of it is Sally is standing up, leaning over me saying, I got a great job, loser. You did not. And everybody's looking at me. And I'm thinking, you know, okay, nice. I hope you get fired. I don't want you to drink. That's the unforgivable sin. But I hope you suffer. And I got to that place that we get. You know, literature talks about jumping off places and crossroads. And I got to that place where I was going to drink, throw myself into this, put a gun in my mouth. Because I could not stand walking around in my own skin anymore. That's what happens. I mean, my fantasy really was if I could just peel off my skin and step outside of myself so I could stop being me for a while. I just wanted that relief. And alcohol used to give that to me. And then instead it made it worse, that turn. So I went to a meeting one night and I thought, okay, I'm actually... this will be novel. I'm going to tell the truth, which is I'm going to tell these people at this meeting that I'm not getting this at all, that they're all, you know, oh, isn't this great? No, it's not great. I'm thinking of killing myself all the time. That's low on the great scale. So I go to the meeting and it's a meeting. There's a nice, usually like 20 to 30 people there. And there's always coffee and cake and cookies and everything. And I show and the coffee's all made and the cookies and the cake and everything are there. And not a single, whoever had made the coffee had left to do something else. And none of the other 20 or 30 people showed up. And I thought, you know, this is typical of my life. If, you know, if Mia needed a meeting, oh, we'd be like, the room would be filled. Ryan needs a meeting. Nobody shows up. And I was ready to go. And then this guy, Tom, came in and he said, where is everybody? And I remember thinking, how would I know? I mean, you're the member. See, because I'm just a guy who's passing through. I'm doing enough. I'm not going to AA to be transformed in AA. I'm going to AA to say I went to AA. The filter it's running through, what effect do I think me saying I went to AA is going to have on you? Is that going to cause you to let me do what I want to do? That's my AA spirit. And he says, why don't we have a meeting ourselves? Which struck me as like, loser, you know, terrible idea. But whatever it would have taken for me to say no, I didn't have anymore. I was just too broken. And he said, so what's going on? And it all came out. And there's this, that my very favorite AA pamphlet is A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a description in there where the guy talks about our need to stand naked before another human being. Not the way we did it drunk, much to their surprise, but really to stand in front of them, stripped of all pretense, showing who we were. And to the best of my ability, that's what I did with Tom. And because he was a guy who understood his illness and understood the solution, he was able to participate with me in that, you know, and that's the gift we get. If we are willing to do this, we get to participate with God in the creation of space for some of the most ill people in the world. And when people get well, their spouses get better, their children get better, their parents get better, everybody we touch. Problem is we think of ourselves too, I mean, part of being self-centered is I think of alcoholism as something that's happening to me. Oh, poor me. I fell out of a window. I didn't think at all. My parents getting a call saying, you know, your son's dying, your pride and joy, who you thought was going places might not be here by the time you make it up here. But I don't see that when I'm in it. I feel like it's a big pain that they're upset. And so he really was the door through which I really walked into AA. And I started working with a sponsor. I got a sponsor. I initially got a sponsor for the same reason I went to AA. So I could say I had a sponsor. So the filter, when it came through and you heard I had a sponsor, you would say, good job. And actually this woman used to always badger me about getting a sponsor. And finally I got one and she said, did you get a sponsor yet? And I said, yes, I did. And I'm waiting for the great. And then she said, who is it? And I told her and she said, ugh, I guess he'll do. But she loved me enough to nag me into getting it, to stick with me. You know, I started with him on the steps, and I had this other incredible moment where I came as close to going out as I ever did from the time I put down a drink to now. And people had told me that moment would come. And there was a guy in my first home group who always used to say, you know, there will come a day when no power on earth will keep, that the only thing between you and a drink is your relationship with a power greater than yourself. And you'll either have it or you won't. And if you don't, you're done. And I knew I didn't have it. As I'm sitting there in that moment, I knew I didn't have it. What I didn't know then, but I do know now, is that there's a promise in the second step that says God does not make hard terms with those who seek. And so I'm sitting there and I just closed my eyes and basically said, look, if you don't help me, I'm done. And the only way I could describe it was like something physical happened. It was as though something just reached inside of me and pulled something up. It's the only way I can describe it. It felt like something was just being lifted up outside of me. Of course, the guy I'm with is like, who's a drug dealer and used to seeing people talking to themselves after they use drugs, was wondering why I was talking to myself already. But those kinds of things that I stated. So we, you know, I end up kneeling down with my first sponsor to do the third step prayer together. And I've done that with countless people since then. And every time it's this incredible moment because you're like being right there with someone who is on the brink of having a completely different life. And are we willing to do that? Because the problem with alcoholism, of course, the problem with getting sober in some ways is we get these nice, rich, full lives. So it becomes, I would love to help you with your agony there. It's the last episode of The Sopranos, you know, or whatever it is. And my standard, I think, is if I don't feel stretched in AA, I'm not doing enough. And I also have this fantasy that unlike everybody else, I actually have stuff on my calendar to do. Everybody else is like sitting around with nothing to do, desperately hoping someone will call them. My schedule, ironically, is already filled. My schedule is like everybody else's. Am I willing to experience that inconvenience, which is how I process it. It always struck me that for a long time, I always thought they never call when it's convenient. They always call when it's inconvenient. You know what I finally figured out? You know when they call? When it's convenient for them. When they desperately need it, that's when they call. It's not about my convenience. Because honestly, if I focus on my convenience, I won't do anything because I'll always have something else I can do. And it will turn out to be something less than what I could do. And I will become something less than I could be. But my head will tell me, no, that's the move. So I wrote my first fourth step, did my first fifth step, with somebody and really, you know, an imperfect fourth step. The important things about it were, there was actually only one important thing about it, which is that I did it. I sat down and I wrote it out. That's what matters. I don't think God is hanging out there saying, oh, sorry, the book says in black and white and you used a blue pen. You don't get it. I just don't think that. I think, and that's also part of my understanding of God as I understand God has changed and grown, that I have the real sense now that I didn't have, that God yearns for me. He's trying to draw me close. In the same way I yearn for my children, except without some of my human limitations that also can yearn that they would be different in moments. You know, can you just do this differently? And I think that's stripped from God. And so so I did that. I, you know, started that lifelong process of six and seven and being open to ongoing transformation. At first, I thought it was an event and that I would say, you know, please remove all my deviant character. And I wasn't even thinking about the part to the extent they stand between the usefulness to me and to you and my fellows. I was thinking to the extent they stand in the way of my usefulness to me. But I also only wanted them removed selectively. So the things like, you know, you think of the 12 and 12 uses the seven deadly sins of pride, envy, lust, greed, anger, gluttony, sloth. And so I'm approaching this like, okay, sloth, I don't want that. That gets in the way, gone. Gluttony, I just associated that with overeating, not really understanding it. I don't want that either, gone. So that's two, you know, we're making progress. Envy, very painful to me, take away the envy. So now I've only got four left: pride, lust, greed, and anger.
the greed, if you could make it not obvious, but also don't take off my edge that I'll need to do things that I don't want to do so that I can get money. Pride, same thing, like shape it so that it's not offensive, but that people would look at me and say, wow, that is one rightfully proud man. Anger. I had terrible problems with anger, terrible problems with rage. I had them sober and they came back again in long-term sobriety. And it's something we don't talk enough about in AA, I think, because there can be so much shame about it. But I have the kind of rage that I'm like totally fine here. And then this is like flipped, you know, the spittles fly, they're totally crazed. When we were talking about anger, God, I would like you to get rid of that. Except I need to leave it in reserve in case I need it. So if I can have managed rage that I can call out when needed so that nobody can push me around, that's good. Don't touch the lust. Amen. You know, and that's sort of where I was coming from. You know? And here's the thing about that though, is my experience of God is that God meets me where I am, but doesn't leave me where he found me. So my ability, that's where I am. That's where I get mad. And as I move forward, of course, all those things turn out to be disasters that I need to let go. So I ended up going back to school. And I knew if I didn't throw myself into this, I was never going to make it. That was another gift of clarity God gave me. I know there are people who sort of bounce around the edges of AA a lot and you don't see them for a while and then things get bad and they come and they have to go to discussion meetings so they can talk every night for the next 11 nights. And as a pressure relief valve. And then they're going to stick around and then they drift again and they're gone. And then they come back. God bless them. If that works for you, I don't like the taking the meeting hostage, but other than that, God bless you. I'm not that guy. I am never going to make it. And there's a gift to that, is I don't have to try. Cause I describe myself. I'm more like smoke or water, that if there's a crack, I'm going to find it and try and slip through it. And God gave me that clarity about myself and my alcoholism. I am not that guy who's going to make that. So I really threw myself into AA, and I started sponsoring people. We're taking meetings into rehabs and prisons and detoxes and psych wards and starting meetings and sponsoring people, everything. And finding out that all of that stuff, which frankly sounded terrible to me, I think I would like to go to prison Friday night, or I could go on a date, one of these two. Those things turned out to be this incredible gift, that when I am participating in that is when I am most alive. And when I am trying to withdraw to protect myself and protect my time is when I am least happy. And in my head, it should be backward. But it's not. That's how it really is. So I did that. I finished school. No one ever expected that would happen. And had a great experience. It was like tale of two students, basically. The drunk one and the sober one. And had this incredible experience. I moved after that to go to graduate school, and I moved to an area where AA was very different than what I was used to. There was much less, at least as I was hearing it, much less talk about having a transformative spiritual awakening and much more talk about my neighbor's cat yowls in the middle of the night. And I called my sponsor back in New Hampshire and I said, it was a mix of fear and judgment. And I said, I'm afraid I'm going to drink because this is crazy. And he said, you were raised in a very solid AA tradition. So if they don't know what AA is, it's your job to tell them. Now, in hindsight, he might have been like needling me, but I didn't hear it that way. I heard it as a commandment, and I went. And I can tell you, just in case you've been thinking, you know what I would like to do? I would like to make myself the least popular person in Alcoholics Anonymous. How do I do that? It is easy. Move to a new area and say two things. Number one, you don't know what you're doing. Number two, lucky for you, I'm here.
And if the tradition had to said, you know, we need to, you need to have a desire to stop drinking and we need to like you, I'm gone. But it didn't have that. And then after a little bit, I was talking to my sponsor. He said, how's it going? I say, you know, they're getting it. And basically, and he said, now these people who don't know what they're doing, are they drinking? And I said, well, no, but what does that have to do with it? They're doing it wrong. And he said, okay, you've told them what AA is. Now it's your job to listen to what transformative moment for me, because one of the ways the bondage of self manifests itself for me is that I walk through the world fully consumed by the fact that what is going on in my head is much more interesting to me than what's coming out of your mouth. And so I have conversations with people in which I speak and then I pause and they do something. But then I've gathered my thoughts and I start again. And the problem is sometimes it's kind of difficult because they haven't figured out that their part's over. So they're talking. And sometimes I've moved on to a completely new subject because I'm not listening to them at all. I don't. Inability to form a true partnership with another human being. That's what self-centeredness looks like. It's not some theoretical thing. And we talk all the time about how God speaks through other people. God does, but I still have to listen. I thought listening was a passive activity, that I'm either talking or I'm listening. Not true. I'm either talking, not talking, or listening. I can be listening while I'm talking. I can be not listening while I'm not talking. And it is active. And can I start to see other people as I am? And there's that, you know, that great line, the great reality is deep down within us. And what we do is the promise of that third step promise is if we try to stay close to God and do God's work well, we get provided for. Well, part of doing God's work well, as far as I can tell, is connecting with the God in other people and trying to care for people around me. Take care of God's children in the same way that when people are kind to my children, it completely shapes how I think of them. And and I believe God gives me that same kind of grace. So I'm kicking along now. I finished that. I did a bunch of traveling in there. Got to go to. I'm sponsoring lots of people still, and a bunch of them drank. One is now sober, like 37 years, I think. And people along the range. And after at one point, I remember talking to somebody and saying, you know, these guys, a bunch of them in a row, all drank or quit AA. I have that charming effect. I was like, I don't think I do this well, which is another way, by the way, just in case you're wondering, in case your head has said that, that is an alcoholic way of saying, so I don't, by the way, because I get better at everything I don't practice. But the answer I got back was, did you drink? No. And the reminder, never lose sight of what you're doing. We carry the message to keep ourselves sober. People take the message and implement it to keep them sober. They don't have to take it. And sometimes people won't. My job is to carry it. And that's what I had to do. And so did that, moved out from finished graduate school, moved off into the working world. I've described myself as I was the greatest employee in the history of North America until I started working full time. And then, the nature of my work—it's all about conflict, and there's, you know, money moving around, and there's a lot of egos, and probably like everywhere else in the world. And what I found is one of the ways the spiritual illness would leak out for me. You want to know what you think about God? You want to know what your higher power looks like? Ask yourself what you're thinking about all the time. Ask yourself what you're talking about. Ask yourself where your energy is invested. That's what God has become for us. And for me, you know, and maybe this is a common, if not natural, consequence of growing up without money. Money seemed like the answer. And it becomes that higher power. And I started to chase it.
and the gift of staying engaged. I'm going to meetings. I have a sponsor. I'm sponsoring people. I'm staying. I'm practicing the steps. I've cleared up the past. I'm doing 10, 11, and 12. The gift of that is, as long as I'm staying engaged, that wrong chase, it starts to grow, you know, because it feels inauthentic. And the question is, what do I do with that? Because one answer is I turn to God to have it relieved. The other answer is I push God aside and I just go at it harder. When things don't work, I just do more of it. And the gift I got was the opposite, turning to God to be relieved of that. And as that relief came all along, all kinds of other stuff started to open up in what I am able to do and contribute in a workplace. And it's funny, as I kind of moved up the chain, people will often say, you know, you do this, like you manage stuff very differently than other people. And the truth is, it is all because of how we treat people in AA. Because we don't have leaders, you know, we have servants. And so, and if you bring that into the workplace, it's a different, it just, the approach is different. At least that has been my experience. When I was sober 9 years, my wife and I got married. We celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary this past October. And I'm going to say something, and this, trust me, I know this is a low standard. So I always feel like I need to preface this with this. In that time, I have never hit my wife. I've never come close. I have never cheated on my wife. I've never come close. I guarantee you, drunk or just dry, I would have done both. That's what my illness looks like. Two children, one's 27 and one is 16, every 11 years, whether we need one or not. And both desperately wanted and desperately loved. But that same thing, I've never hit them. I've never come close. I've been present with them unchecked. I would have done that. You know, I would have terrorized them. And there was at one point when all of a sudden out of nowhere, rage started coming up around me with my son. And I'd be like, fine. And he'd do something. And I would go from, hey, yeah, isn't this great? To, I had to knock his teeth. And it's kind of like, where did that come from? The gift of AA was, I heard that on one side, and on the other side, my head said, you know, that's crazy, don't you? And I finally understood in some ways that my father didn't have that. You're crazy. You know, that doesn't work. That he was trapped in the other one. And I got to be different. And so one of those things that that happened for me is, you know, people had talked to me about, when I got sober, you're going to have to make amends, and you're going to have to make amends to your father. And I'm thinking, like, are these people even listening to me? Because I had what I would have called the litany, which is, you know, I remember my father breaking my mother's arm. I remember my father would have her on the ground and he'd be kicking her. And I was the oldest boy. And so from a really small, I mean, I'm knee high. I mean, I remember trying to wrap myself around him really young, all the way up. And I had the sense that it was my job to do that as the oldest boy. Nobody told me that. And, you know, she'd be unconscious on the ground, and I'd like find Vaseline, which was the only thing I knew to do. And that's all I could talk about. And how traumatic all that stuff. And of course, getting, you know, hit myself as well a lot. And the gift of AA that comes out of that prayer process in the fourth step, where we see people as spiritually ill like ourselves, even if we don't like their symptoms, is I saw my father completely differently. Because no one does that to people they love unless they can't do anything else. And so it wasn't, you know, the poor military analogy that came to me eventually was that it felt like sniper fire. It felt like he was pointing and coming right at us. And it was shrapnel. He was blowing up and we just happened to be there. And he couldn't stop blowing up. But I knew that deep down what he really wanted was a relationship with his children. So every chance I got, I said, no, that's who I was. That's the son I was. And the question became, how do I make amends for that? Because that the problem wasn't, I didn't do anything about the violence. But that's who I was. And my dad was born in Ireland, very poor, raised there. And there's an Irish game called Irish football, which sort of looks like soccer. You can use your hands, some other differences, but basically the Super Bowl of Irish football is played in Ireland, in Dublin every year. And I had been praying, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? And answer came clear as a bell one. You should take your father to the All Ireland. And I immediately thought, bad idea. But I have either invested in something so that I will develop a conscious contact with God, or I have not. And if I have, I need to trust that and follow it. Now, because I'm imperfect, I called my younger brother, whom God had not mentioned, and I said, we have to take our father to the All-Ireland. And he said, you know, he said, we're not, he said, I think tickets are tough to get there. They're impossible to get here. I said, I know, but I'm telling you, we got to do it. And so we're trying, nothing. Like 3 weeks later, my brother calls me and says, you're not going to believe this. He says, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who works for an ad agency in Dublin. And he has 4 tickets to the game and he'll sell them to us. God gave me the tickets. God gave me the money. What I had to supply was the honesty, the open-mindedness, and the willingness to go through it. And we did that. We took my father on that trip. And from then until the time he got really sick, he talked about that as the greatest weekend. And he talked to me that weekend about things that had happened in his childhood that he had never told. See, if we do this, we participate in the creation of space with God for other people to heal. I thought amends were just about me getting better. It's about everybody getting free if we can do it. Because of that freedom, that reshaped in many ways how I parented. And I don't mean I wasn't doing terrible things, but just it. I was carrying that around still. And I got free from it. And it was a great gift to get free from it, because in my son started to display signs of alcoholism as a teen. And of course I did, you know, just what everybody does. I thought I would parent him out of it. We're still batting zero on that. I'm praying, you know, well, what should I do here? And the answer comes back, because I'm thinking, what's my move so he doesn't get alcoholism? Wrong answer. I'm looking for the wrong answer. The answer that came back was, your job is to do what you can to make sure that if he needs to come through a door with people on the other side who have the solution, that there's a door and people on the other side with that solution for him. That's your job. So I even threw myself more into service, more into carrying the message. And he kept getting worse. And he's spiraling. And then my prayer process changed from that to, how could you do this? But you couldn't spare him. After everything I've done, everything you've asked me, not true, but close, you know, you couldn't spare him. And the answer that came back was, who better to raise a child with alcoholism than someone who has recovered? And why did I think that this should be foisted off on people who haven't, who have no idea what's coming? And that opened up something that I could see him back to that, you know, great reality deep down within us. I could see him. It wasn't the arrests and the psych boards and the, you know, all the other stuff, the car wrecks and the lies and the stealing, everything. I could see him. And because I could see him, I could behave differently toward him. And so when he needed help and he called, he could call me. And that's, and he just celebrated 7 years in November. And it's been transformative for our relationship, for him and everything else. But the point is, that's not because of me. I could have made it impossible for him to come to AA. Yeah. Do I live AA in my home in a way that would make people think, I don't want to go there? Because if we do that, not only are we not practicing all these principles, we are making it harder for someone likely to suffer with our same illness to get to the right answer. And are we inflicting that on the next generation? And so, and all of this, I need to pay attention to the time. Yeah, I'm running up here. That you know, all of those things continued to change. And it's funny, of course, now he complains about new people. It's so perfect. You know, they, it's like, and it's, you know, it's, they all call at the wrong time. I mean, it's like, it's just great. It's but we can have really meaningful conversations about stuff that is and really open, and we have this great relationship, and we both happen to really like live music, so we end up at these concerts together, and we're going in, and he'll say, you know, you're going to be the oldest guy here, and I always say, well, I mean, somebody has to be, but then I took him to see Springsteen, and I said, I wouldn't even be the oldest guy on stage, much more I'm now in the audience. But those things, and you know, I have a daughter, who so far no signs of alcohol, And, you know, my wife used to say when she was little that if you looked very carefully at her little finger, you would see that it was sagged because daddy's wrapped all the way around it. She's 16 now. And, you know, I taught her how to drive. And it was this incredible experience of being able to be there present with her as she's learning this stuff. I would have never been able to, you know. Guy sponsor who spent, you know, really struggling thing. It was just over at his house the other night because he's, you know, with his wife and now his second daughter. And he has this very stable life and it is this incredible thing. And my son, when he got back out of rehab and moved back to Harrisburg, ended up getting sponsored by a guy I sponsored. Your job is to make sure he comes through the door. There's a door, people on the other side with the answer. That's our job. I will stop here. This story, this happened years ago, but it's always been for me this like perfect little AA story. I knew this woman who was really struggling. And she went, she went to a meeting like this, except it was open. So there's four families there and probably a better speaker. But the she, because she was talking, she, you know, she has alcoholism. So she went off into the corner by herself, basically, and was crying. And this little girl came over to her and said, "Why are you crying?" And my friend said, "Essentially, it's grown-up stuff." And the little girl said, "You don't have to cry here." She said, "This is a good place. They took my daddy and they made him better." And that is exactly what AA did to me. It took me and it made me better. And that is a gift that is waiting for anyone who is willing to accept it. So I thank you so much for listening and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Wow. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, everybody, again. Truly appreciate you all. We're going to pass the seventh tradition baskets. David's going to pass them for us. We got a nice little Easter basket. Tis the season. Am I right? All right. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from the primary purpose to help the alcoholic who's our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each tribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting couple Kyle's first scream. Hey, Kyle. Awesome. Thank you. Any others? Steve. Awesome. Thank you. We got one over here to the left. Do you have an announcement? No? Okay. Oh, one more. Bobby. Hey, Bobby. Awesome. Thank you. All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. All home group members, please raise your hands. Awesome. Thank you all. Literature is available to my left, your right. If you'd like to purchase a big book, please see one of those home group members that had just raised their hands. The pamphlets are free. Sponsorship questions, sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like information, additional information about sponsorship, I will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. And as always, if you're shy, you can always send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website at simpleactions.net. We are not going to be doing a meeting after a meeting because we just had this lovely all combined meeting tonight. In closing, after we do close up, you know, we would love if everybody is willing or has the time to help us kind of straighten this room up a little bit. Any home group member can probably point you in the right direction on getting the tables up and the chairs back. They go underneath where the food was. And then everybody can come up here and thank Brian in person. And David has agreed to read the last two paragraphs on one.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is David. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's close it out with the Lord's Prayer. Let's try to circle up. Let's fill the whole room. Let's do it.